Polly Whitmore, hello.
Hi.
Wow. I'm not going to ask you how you are.
Great. I don't like small talk.
No small talk. We're going to go straight into this.
Okay, great.
Important, though, that I do a mini introduction, which is me talking through what I see when I look at your LinkedIn profile. I am a recruiter, so it's important that I do the recruitment thing.
Sure.
Okay, I go onto LinkedIn, Polly McMorrow. I'm on your LinkedIn, and I see CEO of McCann London. And then I see nearly a quarter of a century worth of time, 14 years, matters a little bit off today. Mm,
thank you for underaging me, though. That was generous of you.
Underaging, yeah.
Yeah.
At BBH, 14 years, and then straight to McCann London. I'm sure there are so many things that I don't know about that time. What do you think the world sees when they look at Polly McMorrow, and what do you think they miss out on in that little two-part story chapter of your life?
Wow.
Yeah, we're there.
Straight in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll start with what they probably don't see, and then I'll move into what I kind of hope that I present in some capacity or other.
Mm.
And I guess definitely what they don't see is abject chaos and the sort of like teetering on the brink of the apocalypse that is the juggle of just working. Mm-hmm. I'm a mum. I'm a friend. I'm all those things. Yeah. So it's always funny when you look at a LinkedIn profile, particularly from your standpoint, because I think everything feels very together.
Mm.
And I think that just one skin layer deep, there's just an entirely human piece, which is in my case utter chaos, which actually I love. So they definitely wouldn't see that. I think what they would see when they look at it is actually a person who, I love what I do.
Mm.
I really love what I do, and I'm incredibly loyal. And I think your point about my tenure at BBH is one that demonstrates that. I don't say it lightly. It's a privilege to be in the industry that we're in. I love creativity. I love being a part of a creative industry. And I have an absolute belief that right now, in an ever more chaotic world, we need our industry and our agencies and our business and creativity to sort of stand up and represent. So I think when you look at it, you go, I'm a pretty loyal human being. I love the businesses I work in and for.
Mm.
Most importantly, I love the clients that I work with. And I really love the people that work in our industry and particularly in the businesses I work for, which is why I've been that loyal.
Where does that come from? So I see 14 years, right? And you go from all the rungs of a client services human being, account director to managing director, then to suddenly a CEO. From the outside looking in, I go, okay, there's a lot of self-belief. There's clearly a lot of talent in that person that's managed to move up. At that time, BBH would have been possibly the most competitive place to be as an account directing human being and as a creative and as a strategist. But I think it's an agency known for holding accounts for a long time. Audi, The Guardian, da 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 da. So what was it about you? I want you to be as brutally arrogant as you need to be to answer this question authentically. Because I also get a feeling that you're completely head-to-toe authentic. There's no bullshit there.
Big compliment.
What was it about you that you believe people saw that went, okay, she has clear talent, and that made you better, because you had to have been better to become a managing director out of, I imagine, 50-plus client services people.
Yeah.
What was it about you, do you think?
I think I cared more.
How?
I think I understood what I was good at and what I wasn't good at, and more importantly, the latter. And that just meant I worked harder. And that's sort of, it's not like a presenteeism thing. It's more being okay with stuff you're not great at and trying to double down on the things that you are good at. And I think, this is such an interesting question. So I do think I cared more, and I think I realized that there were no hacks to being successful.
Yeah.
And success for me, oddly, wasn't becoming MD or, you know, going up the ladder, and it's strange because I talk to people a lot about this in the business now. Titles are an interesting concept. I know that they're very important, and particularly to your point about LinkedIn, there's lots of important improvement. For me, it was always about influence.
Yeah.
How did I have and use and create my own influence and use that in the most powerful way.
Yeah.
And that was true of me as an account executive as much as it was when I was an account director, as much as it was when I was MD. So I think and thank you, because it's the biggest compliment you could give me to say that I'm authentic about how I, because I don't know any other way, truthfully.
Sorry, just on that point, I find it, and I'm going to get there like straight away, because female CEO, there are fewer of you in the industry, mm-hmm. right? And I feel like then, for a female to be in a leadership position, you'd look up and you probably wouldn't see any, I imagine, in 2005, 6, 7, whenever that was. Back even further, there were fewer and fewer. But the ones that had made it to leadership level, from what I can see, possessed scary, almost toxic masculine traits.
Mm.
So if I was a female looking up, I'd go, fuck, okay, if I want to be a leader in this industry, I need to be, callous and hard and, you know, I'll ditch all of my traditional feminine traits as a leader,
yeah.
My compassion, my ability to be vulnerable in front of people, and therefore I'm going to double down on these things that make me more like an overly masculine man.
Yeah.
I don't get the sense that you're like that as a leader, that you possess these kind of toxic masculine traits. How?
Thank you.
That's not. Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be a compliment, but there's one again. How did you avoid having to do that in your quest of becoming a managing director at an agency?
I love the question. I love this topic, which is I have learnt, I believe, from some really different types of leaders.
Mm.
And to your point of masculine and feminine traits of leadership, it's really important to me that I represent a type of female leadership, but a type of leadership that happens to present in this female form. But I genuinely have benefited from lots of male leaders who have had more feminine leadership traits. And so I think I'm so proud of being a CEO, of being a female CEO of an industry which is more accepting of different leadership styles. Mm. And as you say, I definitely don't assume those masculine traits, certainly not the toxic ones, but the sort of more machismo, more bullish ways of doing it, because I just happen to believe that great cultures can thrive and should thrive with values that I believe in.
Mm.
But I have had the benefit of having some incredible leaders who have skewed more to female leadership traits than male, even though they were in a male form. And so it's an interesting thing that I think I, throughout the whole of my career, in totally different ways, you know, they've all got very different styles.
Yeah.
And I'm not frightened of saying I'm like a magpie. I will just steal anything.
Okay.
Is it magpie? What is it that steals?
Magpies drawn to shiny things.
What are the...
Raccoons steal.
I don't want to be a raccoon.
Why not?
There's a bird that steals. Anyway, there's a bird that steals stuff. I'll think of it in a minute. It's got a little... Anyway, it's fine.
Crow feels more deathy.
I don't want to be a crow either. Ideally, I like a bird that I'd like to be. That's the other thing.
You're a kingfisher.
If I could be, I'd like to be a kingfisher. Okay. Thank you so much.
Again.
So I nick things. You know, you see great... That's what I'm a big believer, that if you see traits in people, or leaders that you love, you should try and not wholesale steal. I just mean learn from and then work out what your way of doing that is. And I really think I wang on, but I think I've learned that from so many people. And there's sort of moments though that they become disproportionately important to you and how you learn.
I get this sense that in the early days, like some of the stuff is natural to Polly. So when you started as a suit, I want to get onto the suit thing because I heard that there was a... So from what I understand, your dad was a salesperson.
Yes.
And I feel like maybe those, I don't know, by osmosis, perhaps you picked up, you know, how to sell from your dad, perhaps. And then you move that into a more commercial world that's not, I don't know what your dad sold, but I don't know if it was advertising to
Carl. No, yeah, okay, but that would be good, wouldn't it? And he found an agency and then I found myself a job. No.
Did you know Sir John Higgins?
Yeah, exactly. No, he sold apparel.
Okay, fine, right. So very different, but still, like, you would have been exposed to somebody using their human instinct to sell something, right?
Yeah.
So I imagine that's... I want to find this bird that mirrors things, because I feel like that would have been the first time that you've gone, right.
Woodpecker. I think it's a wood... Maybe it's not woodpecker.
It's
carry on.
Woodpecker. So that there, I'm imagining there was where the kind of like salesy skills came from.
Yeah.
And you move into BBH and you have to go, shit, I got to make sure I can manage human beings now as well.
Mm.
Can you remember when you found out that you were good at doing that part of your role? Because I feel like the selling part is something that's a muscle that you already had relatively used.
Yeah.
Who taught you how to lead?
Oh, there's a couple of ways of answering this, and I delicately not want to position myself as a politician in this. The thing about my dad, which is interesting, is he was a salesman, but he was, he took selling very seriously, and that wasn't the art of just flogging stuff. Mm. It was understanding customers, understanding how you made sure that they were buying the right things in the right quantities, in the right way that would future-proof them and their businesses. So in lots of ways, that sort of is leading.
Yeah.
So there is an interesting thing about that of just, if you really genuinely want to do right by human beings and by them and their own careers and their businesses, I definitely witnessed that, to your point of it sort of being ingrained in me very early. And then at BBH, there was lots of moments when you realise that you think you've got talent. So you've talked about John Hegarty, Nigel Bogle was one of the other founders. And there was I used to run Audi UK, Audi cars. I have to say Audi cars because now Audi is with us. So I was like, Audi cars. And I used to have a weekly meeting with Nigel to update him on what was happening in the world of Audi because he had a strong point of view on it.
Mm.
And the really interesting thing that I learned very quickly with that was he wasn't there for an update. He wasn't there for a sort of, could I just come and reel off a status report?
Mm.
He wanted to know what I thought. He wanted to know what and how I wanted to lead my team, lead our business, lead our partnerships. Yeah. And that was at quite a junior level.
Wow.
He's going, come and be a leader with me.
Wow.
Come and be a... And so it was a really interesting lesson in... I feel this very strongly. Leadership is learnt very early on in your career.
Mm.
I think your ability to impact is almost at its strongest when you're your most junior in your career. And the way that leaders treat you in those formative years is utterly, utterly irreplaceable. Mm. You know, they're the things, they're the moments that you're made. So I think I was exposed to lots of different ways to be able to really care about people. And I think that's quite baked into my leadership style. So when I sort of first, I mean, I could bore you about when when I was running Audi, I was also head of department.
Mm. When you say head of, you mean
head of account management, exactly, head of client service. And that was one of the most enjoyable times in my whole career. Oh, is that what they look at me? Just effortlessly.
Yeah,
just
gliding in.
Yeah, look at it's the woodpecker again. Yeah. It's not a woodpecker. I don't know what it is. It's not that. I think when I really test myself to think about when the moment was in my career that I loved it the most, but when I felt like I had the most impact, it was running a big piece of business and running a department, that being client service. So I got to get comfortable with what my view of what great looked like and my sort of vision of what good, empathetic, clear, fearless, and fearless is a bit of a cringe word, but fearless sort of leadership looks like.
Mm.
And then I got to apply it on a piece of business that I deeply cared about. So it was, you're not just talking in the abstract, you're talking about what you believe to a department.
Mm.
And then you're putting it into practice every day on a big bit of business that meant a lot to me. So that was definitely...
When you were at your, like...
That was, I think, the first... Yeah, I think, and that's it. When I first really, truly believed that the sort of back to your earlier question, the sort of leader that I want to be and the sort of leader that I lean into could be effective in how I tipped up.
I'm really interested about the word fearless. And it's funny you said it's cringe. It is cringe if you say it in the wrong context. But if I just break that word down, fear, I feel like people that started working in this industry, 2019, 20, like this weird time, you're sat at home, you're having to learn from your computers and laptops, calls rendered. You don't hear anybody screwing up. If you do, they go, oh, sorry, my camera wasn't working. Or
Totally.
You're never...
They've got like notes plastered to windows.
Exactly.
Places, yeah.
All of your things around. You're never in a room quivering where everyone can see and feel that you're so nervous.
Yeah.
I feel like fear and the ability to screw up and that be okay has been removed from a lot of the people that have started within this industry. I feel and see, particularly in the younger generations, there's an incredible amount of fear. And I just wonder what you can do or what we can do as a business, and how do you approach designing an environment where that can be felt less, or at least felt to be normal?
Yeah.
Because I do, you try and get somebody that's, you know, in their 20s, early 20s, mid 20s now to present something or say something or like do anything that's away from the norm, which in this industry of differentiation is so important. How can you design without them, by the way, being told that they're entitled?
Yep.
Because there's the balance. We've got this new generation of Gen Zs coming through and we're saying, be more fearless. And they be fearless and we're like, don't be so fucking entitled.
That. Yeah. So, that type.
Not that. Yeah, no, don't pull the walls down, you know. So how do you balance that? How does one approach, and this is a big question because I'm asking you about a whole generation of human beings, but what little thing can you do as a leader, or do you do as a leader, to genuinely create an environment that leads to somebody feeling less fearful?
Yeah. Well, it is a big question because it's one of the biggest questions that we have to answer as leaders now. I mean, it's our responsibility to be able to set the climate that allows that to happen. And by the way, I feel so... I think it must have been really bloody tough to be someone that came out of school, university, college, whatever environment people are coming out of into the working world in that time. Because I think you're right, there was a whole moment where so many of the skills that you just learned via osmosis, you just haven't been there for. And like you say, one of the most tragic of those is that not witnessing mistakes, or certainly the view that being perfect is something to strive for, because it just isn't. It's just not. And my career is littered with... And it's funny, sort of mistakes is one way, calculated risks.
Yeah, that didn't pay off.
That either did or didn't pay off. And also some of my biggest successes have been on the fringe of failure, or some of the biggest failures have been the biggest jumps to success. It's so... creating a climate and a culture where people want to take those risks is ultimately the thing that I believe in. And I believe in that really strongly. So your question of how do we evolve or create cultures where people understand this, what I mean by be bold, take decisions, feel things.
Yeah,
I think that's where you start is, do you, and I talk a bit about, I love things and hate things, like really strongly. Because that's what makes our industry brilliant. That's what makes creativity brilliant, is to love things and hate things. My only challenge to anyone is, why? Why do you love it? Why do you hate it? Why do you make that decision? As long as you can stand behind it and go, well, I really believed it was going to do this. You're like, that's all I need. That's all I need is, do you believe in the decisions that you're taking? And if you do, it's never going to be a mistake or a failure, because ultimately your decision and your instinct, you're acting upon. And that's what I mean by fearlessness is it's the ability, creating a culture where people understand that they have agency to be able to make whatever decision they want, in whatever way they want, as long as it's in pursuit of something they really totally believe is going to move their business, our business, themselves forward. And I feel it, you know, we pitch a lot, obviously, as creative businesses. And I think it manifests. It's interesting. I think that's one of the most acute places that manifests. So people see every micro decision or every micro movement mm. under such scrutiny. Whether I win or don't win a pitch, genuinely, I mean, of course there's business imperatives to wanting to do it. And the thing I love is I love pitching for businesses and people I would love to work with.
Yeah.
And I love our teams feeling that. You know when you're delivering a pitch that a pitch team has loved working on. You know when you see a performance from an account manager, we had one the other day in a chemistry meeting we're doing, that whatever happens, they've delivered it because they know and you talk to them before it. And the small things are going, by the way, just enjoy this.
Yeah.
And just soak it up. And frankly, if you sit there and you completely clam up and you say nothing at all, that's also totally fine.
Yeah.
Because the next time you do this, you're not. And the next time you know what the environment's going to be like, it's like doing this podcast. Mm. You know, the first time you do a podcast, you know, it's terrifying. You're like, what on earth are you going to ask me? And how am I going to, what's my soundbite? And what's the, being in an environment makes people, I think it's the pressure piece. Positive pressure is a great thing. Negative pressure is a terrible thing. Mm. So this is a very long-winded way of saying it is a big question, but it is probably the most important question because only when everyone is backing themselves to make the right decisions, regardless of outcome, but with the best of intention, is any culture going to reach its potential or any person going to reach its potential? And ultimately, that's what our businesses are, a bunch of people reaching their potential to do really spectacular and extraordinary things for businesses and with businnesses.
I'm going to challenge you then.
Okay, hit me up.
Yeah. It can either be a dumb thing that you've done that's ended up being a brilliant thing, or it could just be a dumb thing that was just out and out dumb thing. I've done many dumb things. Whilst you think about that, I launched a charity agency in the middle of COVID called Good Brains for Good Brands.
Mm-hmm.
Put all of the money that I was meant to buy a house with my fiance into that, and it died, and it was the worst idea ever, but it was a nice thing to happen.
Mm.
That then later on became the only reason that people came to us and briefed us after COVID, because we had 2,500 people that had signed up to this thing in the middle of COVID, which happened to be all of Wyden's creative departments, all of Wolf Olin's, you know, this huge, you know, thing, which in the at the time it would have been a really dumb idea, but actually it was a really smart one. We ran a workshop. This was dumb. And there was no benefit really apart from just creating a room for everyone to vent. We ran a workshop called Nobody Wants to Work for You. If you remember when the Great Resignation was happening, everyone was leaving Adland, particularly in the US. It was, you know, I'm going freelance, I'm moving to LA. And we thought, well, let's do a workshop in London and New York, and we'll get everyone in the industry to be honest about what they hate about the industry.
Okay.
And we called it Nobody Wants to Work for You, and we had three clients call us up and say, we don't want to work with you anymore because...
Oh, my gosh, quite literally.
They felt very tough.
Yes, no, I was going to say.
And
yes.
I was a bit like, well, if you're... But that was a bad decision. I don't think that was a net positive thing for our brand or business. But again, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Yeah.
So I put the question to you. What is the dumbest thing you've done that ended up either being smart or just purely dumb?
Gosh, I've got a career littered with these things. absolutely littered with them. It's difficult, isn't it? Because when it goes well, it feels more intentional.
Yes.
It feels like smarter than it should. So, but again, I kind of, fear. I've made an ad when only one client knew about it. Like made the entire thing, lock stock, did it, flew to HQ to share a fully finished ad with a set of clients that nobody apart from like six people knew about. But it was because, again, to the point of why you're doing it. I did it because, oddly, at that time, I was like, well, we need to do... Everyone's in a bit of the status quo. Everyone's sort of rumbling along with the BAU stuff. We actually need a spike over here. And there was a brilliant idea. And we were like, it's brilliant. It's not going to fly if we go through a million death by a million cuts. This one brilliant client. Brilliant. But I mean, I was like an account director. And the pair of us just went off and made the ad. And then it's forever like... And it was fine because we got over there. And then they went, oh, this is brilliant. So again, to your point of... That was really, I mean, don't, any, if anyone at McCann listen, God's sake, don't go make an ad and then come back. No, do that. I've got aeroplanes. So there's a million ways that I'm trying to think about things that are dumb and have stayed dumb.
That should have been really dumb. Because imagine the client was like, Polly, why are you in the office?
No, I'd have been fine.
Why are you telling us watches?
No, but also completely, what are you doing here? No, of course, But big things and small things. Like I say, I got on an aeroplane to sell an ad, but I couldn't get enough time with a client, so I booked an aeroplane ticket to go on the same flight as them somewhere, just in order to sit next to them to sell them an ad on an aeroplane. Again, that could have gone spectacularly wrong when expenses were challenged. Do you know what I mean? There's a load of problems with that.
Or just super injunction.
Just super injunction. Exactly. Totally weird behaviour. Not acceptable. In this case, acceptable. And we made a great ad. But there's those things. And then there's things that you just... I nearly got fired because... It's a dodgy one. I nearly got fired because at one point when I was running a piece of business, it had been one of those tumultuous times. It was quite hard going at the time. I took the whole account team, the whole team, like all 42 of them, whatever, out for dinner because we just needed to just go and be together. And it was just a really important thing. But it happened to be at the time of relative austerity in the agency world. And it definitely wasn't seen as a thing to be doing, taking 42 people out for dinner. And I don't say lightly, I sort of nearly got fired, but I definitely was reprimanded pretty strongly about it. And this is where my point about stand behind the decisions you make are, which is I absolutely understand that that's a risky thing to do. And frankly, it's at odds with the way that I as a leader, as an account director, whatever I was, business lead, should be looking out for our business. And that's not about not understanding our own business. It's about going, right now, this team needs motivating. Mm. This team needs a moment to decompress together. And frankly, whether or not that cost £20 or £200, the single most important thing we could do right now is to be together and to do it. And they, that team was this incredibly loyal, fearless, brave, exhausted team. Mm. And they stuck together. And it was such, I honestly haven't had a team that worked harder or more together. And part of some of those decisions, you take a rap on the knuckles about, and you'll take the fact that you get a bollocking in an office. Mm. Because ultimately, and I can remember saying at the time, I get that lots of the reasons that you're saying I shouldn't have done that are correct. But ultimately, I'd do it again. Honestly, I would. Because I believe that that's the right thing for this team and for the business.
I believe that's the right thing for this industry.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely, I'm not just saying that because you're here. This is missed. This is the 2019 starting their career in advertising thing that they thought they were joining that's not ever come back. Mm. And people are craving it. Cannes this year, I believe the most people are ever heading out to Cannes ever. Because they're going, I just want to be in a room with people just chatting about, even if it's not to the industry, just the reason we got into this wonderful, weird industry is so we could speak to each other and joke around and connect and work together on projects. And it feels like everything went so disconnected and we worked so functionally.
Totally.
It was pitch call after call. Hey, I can see a 30-minute gap in your diary. I can't even get out to go.
Yeah.
That became normality. Mm. And now... I genuinely believe the people that are going to win the best talent are the people that get this thing sorted.
Right.
That back that, look, we're going to do 3 days in the office. I know that's not what you joined, but that's how it used to be. And it was great. And here's why.
Yeah.
The difference I'm seeing in a lot of agencies that do that and do that well versus the ones that do that and do it badly are the ones that are giving a reason, are the ones that go, look, I know it's not enough just to say, come in. Mm. I have to give you a reason that it's going to be better than being at home.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and we're going to come on to the McCann thing. Mm. If I was in McCann's shoes around the time of your appointment, the size that they were, had been, and then gone down to, and were sort of up and down, and I was looking around going, what kind of human being do we need to appoint in the CEO role here in London when we have a fractured, and it wasn't just like McCann at this time, BBH are probably in a similar place, but we have a fractured culture, like every company did at that time. Which leader, which human being, and what traits do we need them to possess should we bring in to change that?
Mm.
I can fully understand why that ended up being you. Because of the story that you just told me, right? There's this kind of undescribable, we always say this with recruitment, there's an undescribable feeling that you get with somebody that they just understand other humans. And you can't see that in a LinkedIn profile. You can't see that in a CV. And I heard on a podcast somebody ask you that question, why you? And I'm not even going to ask you that question because I can see why that was so obvious for, I imagine it was Chris McDonald at the time. But why them? What was it about McCann that you looked at from, you know, 14 years in BBH going, interesting, I have been in the same place for, you know, a long time.
Yeah.
I can change that. What was it about that role? Because I imagine you weren't, that wasn't the first role that you were headhunted for.
No. I like how you phrase this, because I think, I mean, and like you say, I talk about it a lot. There's a sort of interesting academic exercise of interviewing for a CEO-ship. Mm. And again, that's culture. You sort of look, and I take hiring, see that recruitment is such, for anyone out there that's looking for a job, looking to change jobs, doing any of those things, the recruitment process will tell you just about everything you need to know about the culture of that business. Mm. So I honestly take it really seriously. Even if candidates aren't right for us, either at that moment or ever, mm. I want them to leave any interaction with anyone at McCann that they've had with a view that McCann is a great place to be, and that whoever that individual in is has loads to offer. It might not be for us right now, but my God, there's a place out there for somebody that is right. Anyway, I digress. The why McCann? I loved the scale. I actually loved the scale of McCann. Mm. And it's a funny thing to say now, because networks and holding companies and big companies are so at odds with the sort of gritty creativity that we all join to do. And it's, you know, we want absolute autonomy and all things. What McCann had, and as you say, I loved BBH for 15 years. I did want my own sandpit. Mm. And I wanted to be able to have new, different toys to play with. And I honestly don't think there's an agency in London. Well, there will be, but there's, for me, the clients that we had at McCann London were such a draw. Not just the businesses, all of which needed partners who are capable of taking them into the next chapter at a moment when, you know, yeah, during COVID, and we were just coming out the back end of it, and everything was on its like arse, and it was difficult to predict, and like you say, everything was in 30-minute bucket, like everything. Somebody could resign in 30 yeah. minutes, and like fundamentally life could move in 30 minutes. Like everything was about 30 minutes in that time. But so they had these toys that I was so excited about, and as businesses, but also as people. And I, you know, I'd met a couple of the clients, oddly, through life and through things. We've got this brilliant Just Eat client who's called Suze O'Brien, who's amazing, who I'd met. I'd actually pitched for her business from BBH. And Ditch didn't award it to me. And then again, like in a terribly awkward moment, I then rock up as the new CEO of the business that she did appoint.
Next to her on a plane.
Exactly. Just exactly that. Yes, you're right. There's a theme here. And we've got, you know, brilliant exports, got brilliant client, Michael Flatt with that. But so there was brilliant clients that I was so excited to get under the bonnet and under the skin of what their businesses were. That excited me. McCann is part of McCann World Group. And you'll notice I'm kind of going bigger, not smaller, in the way that we are, which is McCann World Group is got some brilliant businesses, a business called Future Brand, which is brilliant. You'll know them. Brilliant branding, architecture, design business that is just excellent. And that's run by a person who I love. And we work really closely together. And we've got that. We've got MRM that sits within McCann World Group. We've got Craft, which is a production fund. So for me as a leader, it meant that my learning opportunities just were disproportionately expanded. Mm. So I already had this brilliant big canvas that I love the scale and the impact that we can make with our client businesses. You know, I love the fact that we can do that and truly impact culture at scale, or impact clients' business at scale. And I love that we can do that in a really plural way. So that's what really excited me as a CEO is, I'm not sure I want to stay completely in my lane because I believe that creativity is an accelerator.
Yeah.
And also it's not defined by how you are. So I don't like talking about it being an advertising agency.
Yeah.
It's a creative company. It's a creative business. It's not an advertising agency. It happens to do advertising really well. But connecting the dots to my brother and sister businesses within McCann World Group gives better answers. I believe.
It's a great answer. How? Okay, thanks. Right. So this is where the world we're seeing is consolidating. BBH, I'm trying to think if they have the equivalent production companies, design agency, you had Zag, but that went.
Yeah.
So, okay. I'm just trying to imagine the difference in scale, because what I'm trying to imagine is the scale of conversation. The difference in conversation that you're now having with Just Eat.
Yeah.
So you've got this, you know, toolbox, sandpit, as you put it, and you're having a conversation with the Just Eat CMO or CEO or whoever it is. How trusted is the advertising CEO to convert a client, CMO, CEO of a Just Eat, to then do brand transformation, branding, and moving up that scale? And it's a really hard question to answer, because I believe this is the challenge that every advertising CEO person is going to be in now.
Yeah.
It's going to be, we need to be taking a larger slice of the pie. We need to be up the ladder. We need to start positioning ourselves as a consultancy, as a business transformation business. We're not just an advertising agency.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. How do you approach that conversation? And yeah, I'm just really curious to understand, like, when does that happen in the conversation with Just Eat? You go, by the way, your brand's looking a bit knackered.
Yeah.
Or like, not Just
Eat. Can I possibly introduce you to my friend downstairs? Yeah. the truth is, I don't, for lots of good and bad reasons, I don't see us as an advertising agency.
Mm.
I see us as a partner that delivers disproportionate returns to our clients. I genuinely do. So if I want to deliver disproportionate returns to the Just Eat business, to the Xbox business, to the TSB business, to, I need to be plural in how I look at your business.
Mm.
So I would genuinely, I look at our businesses, our client partners' share prices all the time. I look at their competitors' share prices all the time. I'm like, why is yours up and theirs down? Let's look at that. Let's isolate that. Why is yours down and theirs up? Why in the top 10 other competitors that are in your subset are all up and you're down? We need to look at it. Actually, we've got... I just think you have to be interested in your client's business, not just in the communications that they do. And I think the minute that you genuinely care about a client's business, it shifts the nature of the conversation, which is goes from, you know how I do you some ads, well, would you like to meet my mate that does... It's not that, or even that sort of, like you say, I still think there's a little bit of a behavioral piece from all agencies, which is to be a bit guarded about their remit and a bit protective, I think, about where they do. And I see our role as McCann, my role as the CEO of that, to open conversations that are, what is right for how your business is being driven forward?
Yeah.
What is right for the future of business? And that's going to include some really challenging conversations. And at moments, that's going to require me going, I don't think this is a comms piece. I don't think this is going to be solved by a campaign. I think it's going to be solved by an experience. I think it's going to be solved by a fundamental architecture reimagination of your business. I think you should better invest the money here, there. I have really good, healthy conversations about production, about the impact of AI, about where things should be automated, which many of them should be.
Yeah.
You know, that is caring holistically about a client's business. And the minute that you're having those conversations, it's not about like selling on or sort of trying to get into new areas. It's more about, well, the right answer is this. Let's make sure we've got the right partner. I believe that they're these people.
Yeah.
And why don't you meet Tom? Why don't you meet, you know, Claudia? Why don't you meet Sally? They're the people that I think they're really going to unlock this conversation.
Yeah.
That starts to be, and so it becomes less about a sell. And that's, I really mean it. That's why actually the access that I have to different businesses means that it removes some of the, some of that protectionism, but also some of the walls that are sort of imposed in what the right answer is and who owns that answer and whether or not that's a complete enough answer. It's going to be a combination, because brands and businesses are moving, you know, bonkers quickly, and their requirements for answers move every day.
Yeah.
So that's just going to require different, and that might just be a conversation, or it might be shift the whole business.
Yeah.
And all of that has to be acceptable.
It's really interesting hearing you say that. I feel like the biggest lesson somebody can take listening to this, if you're a mid-weight level suit creative strategist, is to start to care about those commercials, because craft, super important, you know, what we do, super important, but unless it's driving some brand growth in some area, whichever area is important to that brand, what are you doing? And how are you measuring whether the thing that you've just done for them is going to be successful?
Yeah.
I feel like that conversation's not really, I don't know, not caught on, you know.
Yeah. It's and the conversation and then the behaviours that go with it. So when yes. you were talking earlier about, you know, how much people are returning to an office or, for me, the way that I talked to our business about it, really sincerely, was so many of your clients are having trading meetings on a Monday morning. They're working out where they're shifting their revenues, what the job to be done is for that minute, that hour, that day, that week. If we're not together to respond as a partner to that business, then we're not partnering the business. Yeah. And it just becomes too fragmented and it becomes too easy, as you say, for everything to become a 30-minute meeting. So it's very true of how I like to do business, which is creativity and commerciality should be, you know, held hand in hand. They should intersect all the time, because I really believe it. Brilliant creativity is this sort of intangible magic that happens in a business. And that's really bloody difficult to quantify at times, but it's so important. And unless you can start to knit it back and wed it back to what you need that business to do, what you need that client to do, you can't just extract it and just hope for the best and go, oh, it's magic. It doesn't really matter what it does. It's creative and it's brilliant. It's over there. It's like the best creativity I've ever done has delivered directly back for clients. Yeah. So believe it, deliver it, behave it. It is really one of the ways that I make decisions is, do I believe ultimately that that's allowing our people to understand and the people that I work with to really feel that conversation live in their lives?
Yeah.
Because I think that's what gets you to really impactful, effective work.
Thank you. McCann, 12 months from now, all the things that you've planned go well. Because by the way, we've not even touched it. You had to go into an agency where you knew, I think, barely anybody.
Nobody.
Nobody,
yeah,
right?
So
it's like you've gone to a school, you're the new head teacher, and you've never met any of the other teachers in the school, and you're like, hi, I'm your boss now. Firstly, like, how did you navigate that? Secondly, what did you identify? These are three big questions. So how was that? What did you identify as the things that needed to change? And then my future question is, how are things going to look different in McCann if all the good things that you're planning go well? But let's go back. How did you navigate that?
I think it's a good... You learn so many things in moments like that about yourself and actually about other people. It was a really odd time. We weren't back in the office at that time.
Yeah.
So I rock up in an office, to your point. So I'm the head teacher going into the school and there's nobody at school. So you're like, oh, well, this is a little odd. How do we establish a rhythm? So one of the first... Well, firstly, I will forever be endlessly grateful to a couple of people who sort of went out of their way to make sure that I knew them, or that I was starting to get a grip of people. But it was really weird, and I think you do get a real, takes you back, as you say. It's a bit school-like. It's a bit first day of a new job. It's a bit anything. You know, that never goes, however senior you are. You've still got a sense of trepidation. You've got a sense of, how do I make an impact in a positive way, but not in a way that isn't cognizant of the fact this is a very live business.
Yeah.
You know, this is a very live, very healthy business that I'm coming into. And so you want to be respectful of that, but you want to be able to make your mark. So the whole thing was bloody odd. But frankly, it's honestly helped, I think, in lots of ways, gave me a blank canvas.
Yeah.
Because I didn't bring anything with me. And having been at BBH 14 years, part of the reason I wanted to take another job was to work out what's muscle memory, what's just because I know it. And so the feeling of discomfort, again, back to that sort of fearlessness, sort of readiness to make mistakes, is, okay, let's work out what I think I need to put in place as the first things that are going to establish it. And one of the first things that I put in was, so I still do it every single Monday. I talk to the agency every single Monday. I stand in the middle of the floor.
What do you say?
I sing sometimes. Yeah. I'm joking. I don't sing. I talk about absolutely everything. I talk about the shape of our business commercially. I talk about pitches. I talk about brilliant things that are happening creatively. We have teams that stand up and talk about work that they're really proud of. We have. I talk about GPG a lot. I talk about the way that our business is, gender pay gap.
Okay.
So I talk about how our business is evolving. I talk about absolutely anything. Talk about individuals that have done brilliant stuff. I talk about, I talk really, really candidly about all of it every single week.
Wow.
Because they're ultimately the people who are holding, who should be holding me to account as to whether or not I'm,
yeah.
You know, if I'm asking them to lead in ways that are transparent, but are also fair. And I sometimes, yeah, it's a really important moment in the week where really early when I didn't know a single person, I was doing it predominantly on Teams, through to now when we have everyone in the office and you stand and you, it makes it feel very real.
Yeah.
It makes you as a leader realize and recognize that, you know, those 200 people that you're talking to are the reason that you have to lead, and you have to lead in a way that you believe because they're looking to you.
I've got two major questions that I want to ask, and annoyingly they're kind of, I think they could be linked. I want to go GPG, my new acronym that I know.
Oh,
I
yes, now know. You're welcome.
So yeah, thank you. Also an embarrassing one to say, what does that stand for?
No, it's that's absolutely like the last acceptable.
One. What is GPG? Gender pay gap. So what needs to happen here? So I have a little thing called Good CEOs, which I'd love to invite you to after this. And there's a brilliant lady in there. I think I can name her, called Carly, who runs an agency.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a huge thing for her as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an open discussion together as different CEOs to say, like, why is this still a thing in 2024? And what are the little things everybody can do to make a difference? And which are the parts that are you owning? And can you own and make a difference on?
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of questions there, but yeah. Why are we still here and what needs to change?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to say I'm passionate, but I really believe, I'm thinking about this precise about this. I believe that if you want to make a shift in the makeup of your business, then you have to be intentional about it all the time. And that's not, sometimes that's not easy, but it's also not marking a moment in a year. I have I'm a huge fan of the gender pay gap being something that we need to report on.
Mm.
But it's all too easy to think that that is something that happens on the 5th of April every year, and what do my data figures look like? I really mean it. I talk every single time I stand up, not every week, but actually any time I stand up and talk to the agency at large in a all agency meeting, or I'll tell them the GPG of that day. So I have a whole system that has been put in place at McCann where anybody at any time can go, what's our GPG today?
Wow.
Where do we sit now? Give me as accurate a figures as you can today on Thursday. Because again, I'm, as a female leader and as someone who really believes that difference is what fuels great creativity, it always has. It's the sort of alchemy, actually, of humans. But for a long time, it's been done in a very mono way.
Mm.
And so to shift it, it's a whole, in my view, it's a whole load of small things that every single person. So be intentional. And if you want to change the makeup of your business in any way, it's going to come with a degree of pain. And by that, I just mean you've got to be prepared to, you know, hold out for talent that you think is going to make your business better, and hold out in moments that it might be easy to make some decisions to do things. If ultimately what you want to do is shift it, then so I'm funny about it, because I'm like, it shouldn't be a challenge. It should be a thing that you want to make your business better, because it ultimately means that you have more difference in your business. And So it's a gradual thing, but it is a thing that I'm really proud of. You know, our leadership is predominantly female, but I say that almost like they're also predominantly world class at what they do.
Yeah.
They're world class people at what they do. I love that they're female because it just makes a diff. It just means they just give a slightly different answer. But they weren't hired just because they were female, and that's a really important part. I believe in world class talent, and I think it's really brilliant when it carries traits or in form that is female, because I think that we have a really interesting perspective on the world. So it's lots of little things, but that's all parts of the makeup of a business, and you know, that stretches and expands to everything. So I mean it as, again, like I talk about it as a routine part of our agency.
Mm. How I love that you're reporting on that on a daily basis. Like that's incredible. One of the things that we heard a lot was actually the things that guys can do that men can do, which is take the paternity leave as well.
Yeah.
And you know, there's loads of things that men can do to improve this, but that's one of the small ones, and it's going to benefit you as well, and your relationship with your child and your partner as well.
Totally.
Like, it's feel like we've just done a we've gone for the share parental leave thing, which for a small business is it is scary, and I have to be honest, you know, we have a 50-50 split leadership team, and I think the guys will probably have children before the girls, and half of them are our key performers that drive a lot of revenue to our business, and we are saying, you know, you can take 6 months out.
Yeah,
that is there. I can't lie, that is a commercially scary thing.
Yeah,
but I know, and it's the mini thing that I can do to make sure that we're creating a completely equal situation here.
Mm.
And I think you have to champion that stuff. I'm not trying to say it just to sound good and to sound like, you know, moral. Yeah. I think that's the only way we're actually going to see change. It's the part that belongs on the guy side.
I love that. By the way, I love that you do that. And I think that's that pain that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Which is, progress has to have some growing pains.
Yeah.
And it's going to have some bits. And it is, but it's bold. And it's genuine. I really mean it. It's brave of people who have businesses like yours that are making those moves.
Mm.
Are the things that are changing it. Because ultimately, it's a little bit easier for me.
Yeah.
You know, that's... we can have progressive parental policies, and it's still very impactful for our business. It's still ultimately difficult in how you think about resourcing that and how you do it. But I do think that, again, it's a more seismic cultural shift.
Mm.
You taking some very difficult decisions about your business for the greater good of the way that we, as creatives and as creative businesses and as people who deal in people, look at this. It's really important, because you do have a tougher time. And I really say that, I don't say it lightly. I think it's amazing that you're doing it, and I salute you for doing it, because that will have such, those are the things that have such a big impact on how much we normalize this.
Yeah. It's funny, because I think everyone should pick something. I think the problem that we saw, particularly post-COVID, is everyone picked everything.
Yes.
We care about mental health, we care about gender pay gap, we care about inclusivity.
Mm.
Yes, all these things are really important. But what you're left with at the end is a business that doesn't really care about any of them.
Totally.
And you get this kind of pots are filled up by 10%, kind of. And what I like about you reporting on that specific thing on a daily basis is that you've picked the one that is the most important right now.
Yeah.
And therefore you're measuring it and showing it. And I think that's really key, is... The thing I think is weird about this society is you'll get some people launching rocks at you going, well, what about this other thing that you should care just as much about, that thing? And just because you say that you care about something doesn't mean you care about something less, or it's not as important. But if you say that you have to care about all of it, nothing changes.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important to pick a lane. So yeah, well done for doing that.
Thank you.
I wanna move, as well, I know we're kind of over time, but I've got one or two questions I still want to ask. One of them is quite a personal question about Mini Polly. Which I'm going to ask at the end, because I think it's a nice way to finish. But keeping things McCann, and I guess, you know, speaking about the stuff that we've already spoken about, if all the things that you have planned go well in the next 12 months, what will be different if I was to walk into McCann London in, what's the date today? Sometime in June.
Yeah.
In 2025, what will feel, look, smell, sound different about McCann London?
Well, I think we're coming, to your point, I think we're coming off a really bloody robust 24. And by that, I just mean businesses are made up of their people. And I think we have some of the very best people in the world. So I love that. And I think we're, but also our industry is ever changing. I get really excited about the changes in our industry, get really excited about difference. So I get really excited about new clients coming in. I get really excited about new people coming in. You know, like I don't, there's people that I already know are going to come in. There's people that, you know, we're pitching for stuff at the moment. I get so excited about going, what is the shape of our client base in 25? What is the shape of our makeup in 25? And what's the shape of the output that we're doing in 25? Because all of those are going to evolve. And that's incredibly exciting. And what I know won't change is having a disproportionate hand of the top talent, which I love. And I think, you know, is ultimately what I care most about. But having a business that's hungry and energized by change.
Yeah.
Because our clients' businesses need us to be iterating and innovating and thinking about new, different ways of doing business all the time. And some of those we can project into the future, and some of those we can't bloody project at all, and you can't work out what's coming around the corner tomorrow. And I get really excited about it. So it's a sort of slightly fluffy answer to go, I'm not entirely sure, but what I know is going to be there is really bloody exciting. And what I know will happen is, I want us to be at the absolute forefront of all of those different wonderful changes that will happen and making our business as relevant as it possibly could be for the clients that we've got.
Do you know what I love about that answer? Is there's not a bullshit statement. Like, you could have turned around to me and been like, we're going to have...
Sometimes wish I got a few of those.
But I get this feeling with you that it's constant evolution and progress forward, and it's intentional. That sounds really fluffy. It's
welcome
rare to hear.
My world.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck, I'm a fluff ball. But it's rare to hear somebody that's okay with not knowing exactly what the change is going to evolve into, but it will be a positive one either way.
Yeah.
And there's something quite stoic and wonderful about that. I want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
Polly, but she's 2025 version. No, 2024.
Okay.
I'm in the future.
Gosh.
She's like just about to enter the industry, and she's 21. I'm going to say, maybe 22. Mm-hmm. When did you enter the industry?
Can't quite remember. I'm so old, I compare.
In 1864.
1402, yeah. I was... like 21, I think I was 21.
Okay, fine, 21. So there you are. But it's this age, right? It's 2024 and you are 21. Lots of 20s in this question. What one piece of advice would you give to younger Polly that's entering this world now?
I would say... be really okay with the mistakes you're going to make, because they will ultimately lead to your biggest successes.
Okay. Thank you. I love that. That's really...
No, it is.
No one's ever done that in a sentence.
Oh, thanks. Well, I'm probably not. I'm probably going to... that's what I believe. I believe that, I think I'm really okay with that now. I wish I was more okay with it when I came into it. I wish I'd really held that tight when I was 21.
Same. Yeah, I was really scared of not getting things right. And then I would berate my... It was more the berating of self afterwards.
Yeah, totally.
Only twice, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah.
But that was the thing. I still do it now. You know, that's why I do therapy every week, because something happens, right, in our upbringing.
Yeah.
Like, it's not our parents' fault. It happens. We're young with these formative brains, where we form these childlike responses to situations. And one of them, I think, which we're all blessed and cursed with, is fear of failure.
Yeah.
And fear then, when we've done something bad, that we are a bad person because of that thing. So what I hear, and I'm taking your thing myself, is if you do fuck up, you know, if you make a mistake, look at it, understand it, but don't berate yourself about it and move forward, which I think has formed you to be the leader that you are today.
Thank you.
Polly McMorrow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've loved this.
I have loved it too.
Great. I'm going to clap now.
I can't wait. Brilliant.